Before the stars had wars, the Empire struck back, the Jedi returned, the Phantoms got menacing, clones attacked, and Sith got vengeful, before encounters got close, before days became independent, before Jurassic got parked, before freaks became eight-legged, before the Matrix got reloaded and became revolting, and before Riddick was chronicled, there was paleo cinema. Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 19. My name is Terry Frost and it is the first anniversary edition of this podcast. Yep, way back in the dark ages of September 2007, using a really crap microphone, I started this podcast. Hopefully the sound quality's got better. I haven't had many people complain about it, so that's always a good thing. And we've built up a bit of a base of people enjoying the podcast, interacting with it, and the downloads are steadily increasing, which is very heartening. So hi to anybody in, say, Trieste, Italy, who's listening to this podcast, the people in the Midwestern states of the US, the people in Canada, the people in the UK, and the people locally, including my old pal Mondi Boy, and lots of others. Thanks for being part of this. And thank you very, very much for the feedback. I don't think it would have gone as long as it already has without that feedback from people who enjoyed the stuff I'm putting out and who offer really good suggestions on things I might use in the future and things I might view in the future. So that is very much appreciated. Now get the administrative stuff out of the way. The email address to send your comments and feedback to is cultguru@gmail.com. The website for the podcast is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. And please, if you have ideas, feedback, suggestions for me, if you want to send me copies of DVDs you think I might like or anything like that, drop me a line, we'll work something out. And indeed, I did get a bit of feedback from the last podcast, the famous one I named after our old mate Serps because he helped me out with the alternative Magnificent Seven. And I did get an email from Serps about it, which is pretty cool. I'll read just some few bits from it. This is him talking, not me, so we'll start off. The audio clip of Sands of the Kalahari captured my attention immediately. I absolutely loved it. Very evocative and with a plague of locusts to boot. Very doom-laden and dramatic, like an old radio show. Imagine my eternal chagrin when you pointed out that it's not on DVD anywhere. But I'll be combing the TV listings for the next airing, if any, and I hope someone will air it soon. I'm glad that you mentioned Hell Drivers because I love that movie. Funnily enough, I only saw Hell Drivers for the first time because their old friend, Weaver Man, sent me a copy. As I told him at the time, who'd have thunk a movie about truck drivers would be so absorbing? And I must commend you on a line you came up with that I will forever use to describe chick flicks. Movies that have Julia Roberts trying on dresses in them. Brilliant and to the point. Well done again. Thanks for that, Serps. That's pretty cool. Hell Drivers. Maybe I should mention Hell Drivers in a future podcast because it is a really good film. It is by Cyan Field, the guy who did Sands of the Kalahari and Zulu. And yeah, it's a dramatic movie about truck drivers. It has a few good actors in it. Herbert Lom's in it. Stanley Baker's in it. Some Scottish guy called Connery's in it. And a number of other really good character actors. Not a large budget movie, set in the home counties in the UK. And for a relatively small budget movie, the characters are great, the action sequences are great, and these great big trucks barreling down country lanes to get the work done. For some reason, and some by some alchemy of cinema, Enfield and his crew make this into an incredibly interesting and dramatic film. If you can get a chance to see it on late night TV or to pick up a copy, definitely do so. It's a recommended one. Serps goes on to talk about The Mechanic, the Charles Bronson film that I mentioned in the last podcast. He says, it's something of an accomplishment that you managed to interest me in a Charles Bronson film. I must confess, I never had any interest in seeing any of his Death Wish movies or their numerous clones. However, I will agree that Bronson was an interesting actor and I liked him in everything from Once Upon a Time in the West, The Great Escape and The Magnificent Seven, all the way to those co-stars with Vincent Price, House of Wax and Master of the World. As I say, never having seen any of Bronson's Death Wish movies, I can't comment on them, but you make The Mechanic interesting enough for me to take a look at it next time someone airs it on TV. The Naked Prey, which is the other film I mentioned, sounds quite interesting as well, and is a film I admit never having heard of. but after your description, I'm certain to keep an eye out for it as well. I suspect that the Criterion DVD will be very pricey, as always, so I have to wait to hope for a TV airing of this one as well. What a pleasant surprise to have your final Alt Magnificent 7 pick, Woody Strode. I'm quite a fan of Sergeant Rutledge and love his little cameo in Once Upon a Time in the West. Sadly, I've never seen The Dirty Dozen, so I'll reserve my judgment until I've seen the movie. That way I won't be talking through a hat. Another fantastic podcast as always. Be talking to you again soon, Serps. Thanks for that, Serps. There are so many interesting blokey action movies that come out of the 50s and 60s with some incredibly charismatic actors. There are not as many charismatic actors these days for some reason. They tend to be generic. I mean, there are some people like George Clooney, who's very much a movie star in the classic mold. Robert Downey Jr., very much a chameleon, but a very distinctive actor, and his work is always at least interesting. Yeah, it's probably good to reflect on that. Why is it just the fact that they're older films and we have a history with them makes the actors seem like they're a lot more charismatic than modern actors, or is it just the fact that they are? They tend to have had life experiences that have broadened them more than a lot of contemporary actors. That whole post-war generation of actors went through some incredible hardships during World War II, and it's kind of annealed them into a harder and a stronger kind of presence on the screen for some reason. I can't really think of many actors that from that era who don't have a presence that a lot of modern actors aren't able to even copy. Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon. There are a few appearing on TV who are incredible actors. A couple of examples that strike me immediately. People like Bruce Campbell. I mean, he's made himself into a light character actor of a very interesting kind. He tends to play the smug, smarmy, aging Lothario kind of thing. But when he's on the screen, you're looking at him and not the people he's with, which is a interesting and quite a useful trait for an actor to have. There are also people like Bryan Cranston, the guy who used to play Malcolm's dad in Malcolm in the Middle, is now doing Breaking Bad, a small HBO TV series. He's an incredibly gifted actor, which is probably why he got a Best Actor in a Dramatic Series Emmy at the Emmy Awards. That one was deserved. Not a lot of people have seen Breaking Bad, but it's a remarkable series. I won't go into too many details because it's not really what the podcast is about, but if you get a chance to watch that series, give it a go, and you will enjoy it. Also got a letter from a new listener, Duncan in Tasmania. Hi, Duncan. Hi, Terry. I just downloaded your podcast from iTunes this morning and listened to the first three while walking the dog in the Evandale, Tasmania wind and rain. Like the fact that you're not snobby about some of the fab old movies that I like, such as The Last Man on Earth, which maybe because it was so cheaply made is genuinely creepy, and I won't watch it if the wife and bairns aren't in the house. I think it means if they are in the house. I've got a reasonable collection of stuff myself. My main interest in films is early 60s British kitchen sink dramas like Billy Liar, Sunday Night, Sunday Morning, etc. But I also dig the Hammer and Mika stuff from the 70s. In fact, come to think of it, anything British up to about 1978. After that, everything is shit, I'm afraid. Well, he says shite, but I'm saying shit. I don't mind American stuff, but being an old pom is maybe why I'm so hung up on English stuff. Other movies he mentions are Psychomania, Theatre of Blood, Wonderwall, Victim, The Caretaker, The Servant, and Dr. Terror's House of Horrors. Yeah, absolutely. I've got all of those ones, and they're great, particularly Victim. Victim's an incredibly interesting and brave movie to make in the early 60s in the UK. It deals with the persecution of gay people when homosexuality was illegal. And, it's one of Joseph Losey's best films, and if you get a chance to see it, definitely do so. It's very, very strong and very interesting film, and very much an historic piece to talk about England as it was in those days before people gained a more enlightened attitude to alternative sexuality. He also talks about my interest in I Spy, the old TV series from the 60s, and asks me if I've ever seen an English crime series, Man in the Suitcase. Yeah, absolutely. Richard Bradford kind of tried to outcool Marlon Brando. He's an interesting actor, that guy, and I do have the Man in the Suitcase series on DVD. Very good scripting in some of those episodes. Again, it's one of those old ITV series. I think we mentioned it on the podcast episode when I was going through the ITV TV genre. And Man in the Suitcase is cool. He also mentions things like The Persuaders with Robert Vaughn and Nari Dawn Porter in it. All of those ITV series are very cool stuff. Very dated in a lot of cases because they were stylish and up-to-date at the time, but they're never less than worth sticking into the DVD player and watching an episode or two when you don't have too much else to do. Okay, he was talking about one of the people he would have put in an alternative Magnificent Seven was Richard Bradford, and he says about him, Christ, he would have outcooled Steve McQueen, that bloke. Yeah, he was absolutely there trying to be incredibly cool. A few other movies he mentions, The Sorceress with Boris Karloff and Ian Ogilvy. Yep, terrific movie, The Caretaker, written by Harold Pinter, starring Donald Pleasence, Robert Shaw and Alan Bates. Good ensemble cast there. Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, Bee Gees, Frampton. He's never going to watch that one again. Once is enough for any lifetime. I agree with about that one. He just has this enormous list that is just full of nostalgia for me. Danger Man with Patrick McGoohan, great stuff. Department S, Randall and Hopkirk, deceased. Jason King, The Adventurer, Strange Report, The Champions, UFO. Yeah, I mean, we're pretty much in the same wavelength when it comes to this stuff. So keep listening to the podcast, Duncan. I'm sure there's going to be other things there that you enjoy. Some of the stuff you may already know, some of the stuff you might not, but you're the sort of person that we do this podcast for. It's really about exploring stuff that hasn't been released 5 minutes ago and maybe learning about things as well. There are things that I've learned from some of the people who respond to the podcast, mostly through their blogs, but sometimes in emails and things like that. We've got to keep this thing going because it is a lot of fun. We're all learning, we're all having fun, and we are going to continue this for as long as I possibly can. It's something that I'm getting a great lot of feedback for. And to be honest, you've got to do things in life that you enjoy, and I very much enjoy doing this. So thank you for those letters, guys. There were a couple of other shorter missives from people, but they're the main two. And now we'll get into the guts of the podcast. Shields of 20%. Okay, the first anniversary podcast, number 19. What I have chosen to do with this one is to look at science fiction cinema. It's one of my great loves. I've been a science fiction fan since 1979, when I attended my first convention in Sydney. Been to a few world cons, been on a number of world con panels, started talking about movies and panels at world cons about 5 or 6 years ago, and I've been doing a lot of that kind of thing. And local cons and a couple of world cons. I did go to one 10 years ago in Baltimore where I had a great time. But science fiction fan right from the word go, definitely. So I thought I'd look first at the history of science fiction films. But this being paleo cinema, history means digging right back to the sources, not just talking about George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. I'm talking about going way back past George Pell, past Jack Arnold and giant monster movies, even past Boris Karloff and things to come, back before Fritz Lang's Metropolis even, right to the beginnings of science fiction movies, basically 113 years ago. We're going to start and then look at how science fiction first hit the screen. Yeah, I mean, anybody else can talk about the crap after Star Wars. They can talk about all the crap coming out now. Sturgeon's Law, written by Theodore Sturgeon, says 90% of anything is shit, and modern science fiction is the definition of that. A lot of recent science fiction is crap. There's only a few good things mixed in there, mostly having to do with superheroes for some reason. But I'm looking at where science fiction started and what we can learn from those very early beginnings. So, as I said, going back 113 years to 1895. It's alive! So what happened in 1895, apart from the first science fiction movie? I dug into Wikipedia, so I've got just a couple of things to give you a bit of a feel for 1895. There was the first showing of the play The Importance of Being Earnest, which was a high note for Oscar Wilde. Unfortunately, it's also the year when he was arrested after losing a libel suit against the Marquess of Queensbury, and he was also put into Reading Jail for obscenity and sodomy and all those other things. So not a good year for Oscar. It's also the year that X-rays were discovered. And the people born in 1895, again, to give you a bit of a feel of things, J. Edgar Hoover was born in 1895, famous cross-dresser who had something to do with law enforcement. Shem Howard from the Three Stooges was born in 1895. Rudolph Valentino was born in 1895. Buckminster Fuller, the guy who invented buckyballs and buckydomes. And Busby Berkeley, all babies from 1895. It's also the year that the Lumiere brothers, Auguste and Louis, created the first science fiction film. Science fiction is about shit. I mean, there's a lot of shit in science fiction, but it didn't start out being about shit. It started out being about pigs and offal. Now, when I say pigs, I do not mean Serpico, Freebie and the Bean, those kind of thing, kind of pigs. I'm talking about oink oink pigs. The first science fiction movie ever made was about pigs. And it was so popular that it was remade a number of times in the next few years. You're going to want me to explain that, and I will. The movie was called Charcuterie Mécanique, The Mechanical Butcher. Ran about a minute. The Lumiere brothers' technology only allowed for about a minute's worth of film to be shown. And here's how it ran. It's probably going to take me a little bit longer to describe the film than it took to run the film. Big box with the Charcuterie Mécanique written on it. A whole bunch of guys standing around. One of them shoves a pig in one end of this big long box. And a couple of seconds later, out of the other end, shoot a whole bunch of sausages and hams and roasts and ribs and everything else. The joke being that the machine basically butchered the pig. Now, I can understand why this was such a funny and interesting thing for people in 1895. Le Halle, the large market in Paris, was also at the time where they slaughtered the animals. So there must have been a hell of a stench there from lots of slaughtered animals, including horses. Horse was on the menu in France at the time, and it's still to a certain extent. But there are a lot of large animals being massacred not too far away from where people live. So the whole idea of a very hygienic, very quick, very non-messy machine that would butcher up and dress a whole bunch of meat for somebody was an incredibly attractive idea at the time. And of course, it was making fun of the fact that abattoirs were so messy. So right from the start, science fiction was about looking at the real world in a different way. When I say it was remade a number of times in the next few years, yeah, it was. Basically, a whole bunch of other guys got hold of cameras and stole the idea and made their own versions of it. There were English companies that made versions of it. There were American companies that made versions of it. The idea of stealing films from other countries and remaking them only a year or two after they were originally made is not a new phenomenon. It did not happen with Sarah Michelle Gellar remaking J-horror films. It goes right back to the dawn of cinema, and it's an idea which would have been nice had it died at its inception, but unfortunately it didn't. So the Lumiere brothers and Georges Méliès did a lot of these cute little special effects-based science fiction films very early on. Méliès particular, because he started out as a stage performer, a stage magician, and he adapted a lot of stage trickery to the early medium of film. Charles Chaplin was a big fan of Georges Méliès. He said that Georges Méliès was a veritable alchemist with light. He could do wonderful things with it. And one of the things I did when I was in Paris 4 years ago was visit his grave at Père Lachaise Cemetery. And there is a bronze bust of the man there. It was a bit difficult to take a photo of because there were terraces to the graves, and I kind of had to balance it at a very odd angle in a very precarious position about 3 meters above another row of gravestones to get the photo that I did get of Georges Méliès' grave. But I'm glad I did go, because the guy was, in so many ways, the father of science fiction cinema. John Baxter, in his book Future Schlock and Future Tense, kind of downplays the contribution that Méliès made to science fiction film, but he was definitely the person who opened up the imaginative possibilities of the medium. He's the first person to try to show the impossible on the screen. Later on, people like D.W. Griffith came along and they found ways to build up dramatic tension and to cross-cut and fade out and all those other things that have been mentioned much more eruditely by Martin Scorsese in a couple of documentaries. But Méliès was the person who said, we can show things that don't exist. We can. Our imagination is the only limit for the art of cinema. And rightly so, he's well regarded for that reason. In fact, one of his films was the very first movie to be pirated. Now, it's not a new phenomenon, pirating movies. The first of the two versions of A Trip to the Moon he made, based on the Jules Verne novel, was made in the 1890s, about 1896, I think it was. And an American guy called Sigmund Lubin got hold of a copy of Méliès' movie, took it back to the States, copyrighted it as his own, and distributed it and showed it around America. The very first case of piracy ever in cinema history. The very first giant insect movie was an English one called A Midnight Episode. Sorry, it was French, I apologize. It was French, called A Midnight Episode. And again, like Charcuterie Mécanique, it goes back to concerns of people in the day, which is very much a science fiction thing, looking at a modern problem through the lens of science fiction. This particular one, the problem that it addresses in a humorous way is the problem of bed bugs in hotel rooms. There was an enormous problem at the time. People just didn't give a shit half of the time. Bed bugs were a problem. Again, it's one of these really short films, about a minute long. A guy gets into a guest bedroom in an inn. He wakes up in the middle of the night with a giant bed bug sitting on his chest. Leaps out of the bed, bashes it to death, lights a candle because he's up, obviously upset, wants to sit up for a while. Sees three more bed bugs sitting on the wall and has them explode by sticking a candle up against them. Bit of special effects, boom. But again, right from the start, science fiction movies were about looking at a problem using humor and using exaggeration. 1897, the first robot movie. We know very little about this film. It was called The Clown and the Automaton. It's a French film. It wasn't one of Méliès or Lumière's or somebody else's. Even the descriptions of this film have been lost, but there was a mechanical man in it. The first one we've got any idea about was Méliès' 1900 version of the ballet Coppelia, the animated doll, which he made as about a 6 or 7 minute film. The technology was expanding a little bit. They could make slightly longer movies at that stage. If you look through the history of science fiction films right up until about 1910, they were full of science fiction devices. There wasn't much plot. They didn't have the length of time available to them to do much plotting. But there were things with mechanical horses, flying bicycles. There were magical hair stories that grew hair miraculously onto bald heads. And other kind of wonders that really addressed the problems of the time. Transportation, how people looked. Horses being replaced by cars. So somebody created a mechanical horse for a little short film. Those kind of things. They're looking at the changes that the 20th century is making on life and using that as a part of their way of approaching cinema. A lot of modern science fiction movies, in fact, could use that kind of an approach rather than just going for the spectacle and the pretty lights and the special effects and all that kind of thing. Look at science fiction as a way of reflecting modern life and aspects of it. Some movies do, movies like Gattaca, but a lot of films, it's more about explosions and special effects and people dodging green screen threats. Films slowly became longer as the technology allowed them to become longer. There were movies in the early years where lost kingdoms were found in the Arctic and a super fast car was discovered which could go from Paris to the Côte d'Azur in 3 hours, and they had speeded up film with this car racing around, kind of making speed racers' car look like a snail. There was even a Spanish science fiction film. The first Spanish science fiction film was made in 1905. It was called El Hotel Electrico, about an automated electric hotel. Of course, the hotel goes wrong and lots of disasters occur because of that. But even the Spanish got into that idea of using science fiction as a humorous way of mocking technological change and the use of electricity. There are also a lot of films using X-rays that came along a couple of years after Charcuterie Mécanique. X-rays really capture the popular imagination, so they have a scene with a couple canoodling or something like that. Someone would bring an X-ray screen in front of them and there'd be two skeletons sitting there doing the same things, being operated, of course, by puppetry. So people were very much interested in technological change even in those days. And one of the things we know about any kind of change is that one of the ways people become accustomed to it is by mocking it. They use humor as a method of acceptance, of heading towards acceptance of things. So that was very much a part of the early years of science fiction. Eventually we got to the stage where full-length science fiction films were made, but I can talk about that on a future podcast. I'll leave it there at the moment, talking, just ending with the observation that I've got a lot of admiration for these guys. They really did have a passion for what they were doing. They took things from the stage to the film and adapted them so they would work as film. They were showmen. They wanted to entertain people. Of course, they wanted to make money out of this. Nobody's saying that they didn't. But they were, their main focus was a love of what they were doing and a passion for exploring the possibilities of a new technology. And that's something that we all know. Podcasting itself is an adaptation of that. We are learning a new way to make radio by podcasting. We are democratizing something that was very much an elitist thing in the past, that communication by radio, and of course people do video podcasts, so television has become democratized as well. We are not that much different from these guys in Paris in small factories 113 years ago, discovering something new. Somebody else actually discovered it, but the Lumiere brothers got hold of it. But finding a new technology and having their own use for it. It then went on to become an enormous monolithic industry, but these guys were almost the equivalent of somebody now with a digital video camera and a bunch of mates making a small film. We still have that kind of grassroots possibilities to film that were in existence 113 years ago. So it is something to dwell upon, that in some ways cinema's come full circle. There are a few film festivals around Australia where people are given 24 hours and so many minutes of videotape to make a short film in camera. There are still the same kinds of things going on that were going on at the original dawn of cinema. And I really do like that. I appreciate that people are still the same as they were then. That's it for my look at the birth of science fiction cinema. I may talk about early science fiction films at a future podcast. It is something I'm interested in, but I haven't quite had the time to do the amount of research I'd like to on that. What I'll be doing next after a little bit of a break is talking about a checklist of science fiction films that you really should see and or own. And I'm also going to look at a science fiction film from 1967, which should be a lot more famous than it is.
Well, you know, as the French say.
What do they say?
Vive la différence.
Which means?
Which means hooray for that little difference.
Okay, grab your pens and pencils, and I'm going to start my list of science fiction films that I recommend. There are a lot on them. I'm going to go through them more or less chronologically. There are probably things that I've missed out on this, but definitely give me some feedback if you can think of some that I have missed and that should be included. Okay, first one is a Russian film called Elita. It's from 1924. It's basically about the overthrow of a fascist government on Mars by good Russian people. A lot of this film is on YouTube. I haven't had a chance to watch a lot of it yet, but it's definitely on my get around to it list. The set designs and the costuming I've seen for this one already make it very interesting to watch. Okay, from there we skip to 1926, Metropolis, Fritz Lang. I wouldn't get a copy of Metropolis yet. Everyone knows about it. It's one of the classic science fiction films of all time. There has just been a lot of new footage found for Metropolis. It was found in an archive somewhere in South America, I believe. And at some stage, a definitive full edition of Metropolis will be released. This will be one to wait for. It's a classic film. Chunks of it have been lost previously. And I definitely recommend that you wait. Pick up a copy of the full edition and just enjoy it in its full wonderfulness. Fritz Lang did a lot of good stuff in the 1920s. He went on to do a lot of good stuff in America too, but his fantastic fiction films while he was working in Germany basically kicked the biggest ass. One of the other ones I'd recommend is Spion, his 1928 film, Fritz Lang again. It's the fourth one of his master criminal flicks after The Spinnen, Dr. McBusey, The Gambler, and, of course, Metropolis. This is your template for James Bond. There is no two ways about it. It has got a lot of the tropes that have appeared in James Bond films. And it is available. I picked up my copy on eBay. It was for sale in an Asian edition where you've got the option of removing the Chinese subtitles. And, yeah, this movie moves along fast. It's got some fantastic set pieces and the master criminal genre is all but invented by Fritz Lang, so definitely pick up that one. The other one of Lang's that I'd really recommend is 1929's Die Frau im Mond, Woman on the Moon. I think Weaverman gave me a copy of this one. I haven't had a chance to watch it fully yet. I've been distracted by more recent things, but it's the first really scientifically accurate science fiction film. couple of rocket scientists called Willy Ley and Herman Oberth were advisors on this film. They later went on to make a whole bunch of rockets for the German war effort, unfortunately, and then got pinched by the Americans for their rocketry efforts in the 1950s and 1960s. But as much as possible for its time, Die Frau im Mond is a scientifically accurate science fiction film. Okay, then we move on to sound films. You got to have a copy of Frankenstein, the original Frankenstein. James Whale directed it. Boris Karloff starred in it. Colin Clive starred in it. It's just the definitive version of this film. There have been technically better versions since then, but never one that had quite the same impact and gothic wonderfulness. Okay, 1932. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the Frederick March, Miriam Hopkins version is very, very good. I happened to pick my copy up in a double edition with the 1946 version starring Spencer Tracy and Ingrid Bergman. They're both on the set, and very good renditions of the story by Robert Louis Stevenson. Recommended to be in anybody's collection. Now, the next one I haven't seen, but I do want to get a copy. If someone's got a copy, spin me one. The Island of Lost Souls, starring Charles Laughton as Dr. Moreau and Bela Lugosi as some kind of hippie, I believe. Okay, that one I definitely want to see. That's on my tick list. 1933, The Invisible Man, starring Claude Rains. I get this one mixed up in my mind with a very, very good parody of it done in Amazon Women on the Moon, starring Ed Begley Jr. If you've seen that, you'll know what I mean. But I still do enjoy The Invisible Man. It's true, more or less, to the H.G. Wells original story. And again, it's just a definitive science fiction movie to have in your collection. Now, the next one's a little bit more obscure. It's called The Tunnel. It was made in 1935. It was an American-UK co-production. It's a big, epic story about a transatlantic tunnel. It stars Richard Dix, who was a big star at the time, and who in the 40s made, I think, Ghost Ship with Jacques Tourneur. Might have been Jacques Tourneur. Val Lewton, anyway, was the producer of it. It wasn't Jacques Tourneur but as a director, but he did make Ghost Ship in the 40s for Lewton. And Richard Dix is your ultimate pulp fiction hero. He's wearing the jobbers and the shirt. He's flies around in a helicopter, which has got a TV linked to his house. It's just a kind of weirdly retro future. I'm probably going to find it somewhere soon. I did have a copy, but it was on VHS and didn't come across very well. That takes us up to 1936, where things start getting very interesting. This next movie, I know you can get it at archive.org. It is the 1936 classic directed by William Cameron Menzies, Things to Come, based on the novel by H.G. Wells, and Wells had a lot to do with the production of the film. Really a classic science fiction movie. It predicts a whole bunch of World War II bombings of London. You've seen it. If you haven't seen it, definitely do so. As I said, archive.org, we've got a copy of it. Give it a go. 1937. Q-Plane, starring Rolf Richardson and a young Laurence Olivier. I mentioned this in the blog at paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. It's a lot of fun. It's an adventure spy romp with a mysterious ray gun fired from an enemy ship, which is downing all the new plane prototypes of the British, and Larry Olivier and Rolf Richardson save the day. It's just a fun pre-war two-fisted adventure, and Valerie Hobson's very good as the female love interest in this one, even though she's not in any way a passive participant in the adventure. So from there, he said, rolling over the page, 1940, Dr. Cyclops, got to get this one. Haven't seen it for a long time, but Albert Dekker makes a terrific mad scientist, and if you're going to be a mad scientist who's shrinking people down to dollar size, the best place to do it, of course, is in the Peruvian jungle. Now, there's not a lot after this up until about 1950. There are some films, but they tended more to be horror. Universal was really big on the horror films at that stage. But 1950, we've got Destination Moon, George Pal movie. I mentioned it in the Pal podcast a while back. It was partially written by Robert Heinlein, classic science fiction writer. 1950s are a really good time for science fiction. There's just so many classic films. We've got The Day the Earth Stood Still, 1951, Michael Rennie, Patricia Neal and Gort the Robot. Been remade with Keanu Reeves in it, hasn't been released yet, probably will be a piece of shit. In 1951, we also have The Man in the White Suit with it's really the only good science fiction movie that Sir Alec Guinness appeared in. I think he did something about 20-odd years later, but haven't heard much of that lately. A classic look at the way technology impacts people. A guy invents a white cloth, which is indestructible, doesn't need cleaning, and this causes immense hijinks. It's one of the classic Ealing films. 1951, we've also got The Thing, otherwise known as The Thing from Another World. Howard Hawks movie based on the John W. Campbell story. Give it a go, well worth it. And When Worlds Collide, the classic, two worlds bashing to each other. One of them, unfortunately, is the Earth. It's got that weird kind of slippery dip thing that the rocket goes up to, which basically would not work in any way in real physics, but it looks really good going up there. The destruction of the worlds doesn't look too good. Maybe somebody can just remake the two worlds colliding with modern CGI and paste it into that film at some stage. Now we're into 1953. We've got the classic Normitz monster movie, which predates Godzilla, The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, with special effects by Ray Harryhausen. I used to have the poster of this monster on my wall when I was a kid. On one wall, I had an Easy Rider poster with Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda. On the other wall, I had the Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. The reason for this is they wouldn't let me have the Barbarella poster. But classic giant monster in New York film. The next one's a little bit more obscure, The Four-Sided Triangle. It's a very early Hammer film, and it is available on DVD. It's about a pair of guys who are in love with the same woman, and one of them happens to be a scientist who basically duplicates the woman. And it's done in a really weirdly rural and bucolic kind of milieu. It's set in the country. There are labs in a big barn, and it's a really interesting film. It kind of seems to be a halfway point between an Ealing comedy and the later things that Hammer was going to do. It stars James Hayter as a local doctor, and he's very good in that. Worth picking up a copy of, or at least viewing if you can get a hold of it. Next, we've got the movie based on a Ray Bradbury short story. It came from outer space, 3D film. I saw it the other week, and it holds up pretty well. The monsters in it are pretty cool. There's some very striking visuals. And it's one of those very, very typical 1950s set in the desert American science fiction films. Okay, War of the Worlds next. Mentioned it in the George Pell podcast. Stars Gene Barry and Anne Robinson. I've got a little bit of a problem with the ending of it, being a good little atheist boy, but it's still a classic and it's still worth being a part of your collection. 1954 gets interesting. Devil Girl from Mars. Now, this is a small British film, which is more of a cult favourite than a classic. Really weird robot, really kinky chick in black leather who comes from Mars. It's set in the Scottish Highlands, and most of it's filmed in a pub. But if you haven't seen it, definitely do so. Next one, 1954, Gojira, the original Godzilla movie from Japan. Don't get the version with Raymond Burr in it, the editions that were done about a year later in America. Go for the original subtitles and all. It's definitely a classic, and it's got a lot to say about how Japan was just after World War II and how the various traumas they went through domestically are reflected in this film. It's a very interesting thing. Then we've got another giant thing movie, Them, Giant Ants, James Whitmore. Definitely see it. It's set up almost as a police procedural thing, a very kind of slightly Dragnet-y Route 66 Highway Patrol kind of film. Just happens to have giant ants in it. Then we've got the only Disney movie on my list, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. It has its cute moments, but it's got Kirk Douglas singing in it. It's got James Mason playing Captain Nemo. It's got a giant squid which nearly drowned half the crew. You got to have that in there. And speaking of water and things, Creature from the Black Lagoon, Jack Arnold's fantastic 1954 film. One of the best of its time. Spawned two sequels. Some idiot's probably going to remake it soon, but I definitely have that on my list of classic science fiction. 1955, Tarantula. giant spider movie. Leo G. Carroll's in it. If you have a look right at the end, when they napalm the giant spider out of existence, the guy in the aeroplane bombing it is none other than Clint Eastwood. So you got to have it in there for that. 1955, This Island Earth, classic space opera, metal and a mutant. some pretty interesting special effects. I was basically taken the piss out of by Mystery Science Theater 3000, the movie, but I don't think it's really bad enough to be worthy of those guys. 1956, classic, the classic of all time, Forbidden Planet. If you haven't got a copy of this, why not? It is the best science fiction movie of the middle of the 20th century, bar none. An adaptation of Shakespeare's The Tempest, so the source material was pretty cool. It's got Leslie Nielsen in a serious role, Anne Francis, Richard Anderson, Earl Holliman, and Robbie the Robot. What more can you want? And the musical score is not really a musical score. It's the Lewis and B.B. Baron Electric Tonalities. They are terrific. I'll just give you a little sting on those. Don't you love that stuff? I do. 1956 still, 1984. I'm not sure from my reference material whether this is the Peter Cushing one, which was made for British TV, or the Edmund O'Brien one. Either one I have not seen. I do want to, and it's on my find a copy of this now list. So I will at some stage do that, but at the moment I don't have a copy. 1956 still, X the Unknown, a Hammer film starring Dean Jagger. It's very much a Quatermass-y sort of thing. And by the way, the other three Quatermass movies are definitely on that list as well. One of the interesting things is, right near the start, Anthony Newley gets sucked into a hole in the ground by a radioactive lot of sludge. So, worth watching, if only for that. 1957, another true classic, The Incredible Shrinking Man. You can't not like this film. Miniature guy up against spiders and cats. It just says it all. 20 Million Miles from Earth, another Ray Harryhausen bit of wonderfulness. Monster comes back from Venus, grows big, trashes Rome. I just love it. 1958, the original version of The Fly, starring our good friend Vincent Price. Can't go past this one. The remake's a totally different film, but I've got an immense fondness for the original. And you're probably throwing there just as a slightly guilty pleasure, I Married a Monster from Outer Space, just to kind of give you a little taste of the B science fiction movies of the era. 1959, On the Beach. Gotta love this one because it was filmed where I live, in Melbourne. Bit of a bummer of an ending. I mean, nobody gets out of there alive, but that was maybe the point. Stanley Kramer made it as a didactic movie based on Neville Shute's novel. The World of Flesh and the Devil, mentioned it a few podcasts ago. Harry Belafonte, Mel Ferrer, Inga Stevens. Three-hander about three people in New York after everybody else gets trashed. Check it out. Eyes Without a Face. The Georges Franju, French film, a classic of the genre. It kind of crosses over into horror a bit, but if you haven't seen this one, rush out and do so. 1960, get into one of the classics of all time, The Time Machine. Rod Taylor versus the Morlocks. George Powell film, mentioned it in the George Powell podcast. Recommended highly. Village of the Damned. Small film based on the Midwich Cuckoos by John Wyndham. George Sanders. Lots of freaky children with blonde hair who can make people do whatever they like. Not a big budget movie, but it shows what you can do on a small budget with a lot of imagination. The sequel to it as well, the 1963 sequel, kind of sequel, Children of the Damned is on the list as well. So add that there. 1961, The Damned, which is not to be mistaken for those two films that I just mentioned. Joseph Losey's film about a group of people who find some children who are part of a nuclear experiment underground. Oliver Reed in one of his first big roles as the slightly incest prone brother of the main female character. very much an interesting film and very highbrow for a Hammer film. 61 still, The Day the Earth Caught Fire, I mentioned it in a previous podcast. Like I did the first movie for 1962, Creation of the Humanoids. I think I mentioned that in the very first podcast. Small budget, but a very interesting film. I mentioned another movie from 62 in the podcast as well, Panic in Year Zero, Ray Milland, post-nuclear survivalist film. And just as a little bit of a spin, I'm going to throw in one other movie which was immensely popular and immensely successful in 1962, and that is Dr. No. Good science fiction movie of its own right. 63, The Day of the Triffids, Howard Keel versus a whole bunch of ambulatory plants with half the world blinded by a meteor storm. Not as good as the BBC adaptation from the 1980s, but in its own way, an interesting piece of genre cinema from its time. 63, got to throw in the very short, I think it's 24 minutes long, La Jetée, Chris Marker's film, which was mostly comprised of still photos. You can find it around on the web if you look closely, and it's a very interesting piece of cinema, remade by Terry Gilliam as 12 Monkeys. Find a copy of that. And 63 as well, X, the Man with X-Ray Eyes, starring Ray Milland, a Roger Corman film, Don Rickles in a rare dramatic role. Don Rickles just won an Emmy Award, and I would highly recommend that one as well. We're getting down to the mug, so hopefully I won't be boring you too much more with these, and we can get on to talk with the about the last movie I wanted to talk about. Okay, Dr. Strangelove, got to throw that in there. I think it's been a bit overdone. I've seen it too many times, and too many people have talked about it. 1963, still First Men in the Moon. Again, Ray Harryhausen special effects. Edward Judd, Lionel Jeffries go to the moon in a Cavorite sphere. Very steampunky kind of film, retro 19th century. And 64, we've got Last Man on Earth. Sorry, it might be 63 or 64. Last Man on Earth with Vincent Price. I think I mentioned that in the second podcast. I'll go through these a little bit quicker, but I'll speak more slowly. 1965, Alphaville, Jean-Luc Godard's new wave science fiction movie starring Eddie Constantine and Anna Karin. Very interesting film which uses normal Parisian backgrounds to be an alien planet. If you haven't checked it out, do so. Crack in the World, I saw this one recently. It stars Dana Andrews. It's about a scientific endeavor to drill down through the crust of the Earth to tap the heat to generate power, and they basically cause a crack in the world. A lot of it's set in South Africa, but it's a very interesting film. It also has Kieran Moore, who was in Day of the Triffids. It's only available on torrent. You can't get it on DVD, but see what you can do with that. And then we go over to Italy for The Tenth Victim. Marcello Mastroianni, Ursula Andress. Ursula Andress has a bra which shoots bullets. It's kind of a reality TV precursor where people can hunt each other for the amusement of the television masses through cities. Very stylized, very pop art. And for that reason, I think it should be in there. Also, Planet of the Vampires, Mario Bava's film. If you haven't seen that, do so. Very weird and freaky and unusual. Lots of forced perspective and hanging sets that make it look like a much more expensive film than it is. 1966, Fahrenheit 451. Not a perfect adaptation of Ray Bradbury's novel, but nonetheless pretty interesting. Francois Truffaut directed it. It stars Julie Christie, Oscar Werner, and Cyril Cusack. Check it out anyway. Very mid-century, cool-looking film. Speaking of mid-century cool, we've got Fantastic Voyage with Stephen Boyd and Raquel Welch. Donald Pleasance. Shrink a submarine down, shoot it into a guy's brain. Zap the lesions with a laser beam, get out before you grow up again. One of the other things I like is Queen of Blood, a Roger Corman film which was made using mostly footage from an earlier Russian science fiction film. It has Dennis Hopper as one of the crew along with John Saxon. But the most interesting thing about this film is the footage cribbed from an earlier Russian film. It should be around the place. I think it may be in the public domain even. And the last movie was 1966, Second, starring Rock Hudson. Very freaky movie about a guy who gets a chance to be rejuvenated by a mysterious company and set up in a new life away from his old one. You'll know the movie if you've seen it. If not, definitely do so. Directed by John Frankenheimer. Let's see, 1967, we're well into pop art now. Barbarella, 1967. Classic film. It's more style than substance, but everybody likes it because of that. A movie directed by Theodore Flicker called The President's Analyst, starring James Coburn. Very interesting film. Got some science fiction elements. Lots of satire. Very much an artifact of its time, but I do like it. 1967 also has Quatermass in the Pit, the Hammer adaptation of the original, I think BBC did it, TV miniseries kind of thing done in the 1950s. Stars Andrew Keir and Barbara Shelley. You've probably all seen it. So now we get to 1968. Charlie, starring Cliff Robertson, based on Flowers for Algernon by Daniel Keyes. It can be a bit glib. The Sterling Silliphant script isn't the best, but the acting does work really well. 68, we've also got Planet of the Apes in 2001. I'm not too fond of 2001, really. I think it's a bit pretentious and overdone and bombastic. And even though Arthur C. Clarke wrote the script, I think it's not Kubrick's best science fiction film. I think A Clockwork Orange is. Some people can argue with that. 1969, we've got Colossus of the Forbin Project, a computer designed to help manage the nuclear missiles, decides to take over. Good film, good solid cast. Eric Braeden, Susan Clarke. Recommend that one. 1970, The Andromeda Strain, based on the Michael Crichton novel. Pretty good raw science fiction. We also got something called THX 1138 in there. Some guy called Lucas directed that. Not sure what he's done since, but pretty good film. Robert Duvall, Donald Pleasance. Not a lot of hairy people in that film. 1971, we've got A Clockwork Orange. We all know about that. We've got The Amiga Man. We've got a thing called Quest for Love, starring Tom Bell and Joan Collins, which was, I think, based on a Wyndham short story. It's about a man who wakes up in an alternate universe where World War II didn't happen, falls in love with a woman, but some very nice alternate universe stuff in there. 1971, we've also got Tarkovsky's Solaris. Slow film, but very interesting. Almost to the end of this. 1972, we've got Deathline, aka Raw Meat. Bunch of cannibals living underneath London who got trapped there. People got trapped there during Victorian times, digging out tube tunnels. Good, solid, kind of horror, monstery kind of thing, but it's science fiction by some people's lights. 72, we've also got Slaughterhouse-Five, based on the Kurt Vonnegut novel, starring Michael Sackson, Valerie Perrine. A good adaptation of the Vonneguts. I think they're going to remake it, though I'm not entirely sure why. 1973, we've got Soylent Green. We've got It's Alive, the Larry Cohen movie, about a woman who gives birth to a kind of vicious cannibal baby, better adapted to our polluted environment than human beings are. A weird and wonderful film, that one. We've got The Final Program, a kind of weird adaptation of a Michael Moorcock novel, starring John Finch as Jerry Cornelius. Kind of a retro film in a sense, in that it's very much more of a mid-60s feeling film than a 1970s one. It's got a few interesting people in it, though. It's got Hugh Griffith in it. It's got Sterling Hayden in it. Yeah, just a weird little film. 1974, we've got two funny films in there. Dark Star, Dan O'Bannon and John Carpenter, a comedy about a deep space mission where things are going seriously wrong. And one of my favourites, Flesh Gordon, the Flash Gordon parody done as a porno film. I'll let you know, I was at the Australian premiere of Flesh Gordon in the 1970s. I did have a poster. They gave out posters at the time. I wish I still had that because it was rather a nice looking poster. But it was at the Academy of Twin Cinema in Paddington. Midnight session in the 1970s. How old would I have been then? About 17. I must have snuck in underage because I know it was R-rated. But that's the sort of thing I was doing when I was 17. 1975, last two films before we hit Star Wars. Death Race 2000, Paul Bartel's movie for Roger Corman, starring David Carradine, Sylvester Stallone. Good fun 1970s exploitation film. Lots of people get run over by lots of funky looking cars. A little bit of nudity, a little bit of violence, a little bit of social satire. Gotta love it. And while we're on the subject of social satire, we've got Rollerball, James Caan as a sports person in the future, run by corporations, remade recently to no good end. And that takes us right up to the mid-70s when Star Wars hit and science fiction films more or less went in the toilet.
Insanity runs in my family. It practically gallops.
Now, this is officially the longest podcast I've ever done, so I've just got to talk about one science fiction film from 1967. The film is Privilege, directed by Peter Watkins, starring Paul Jones from Manfred Mann's Band, and Jean Shrimpton, the fashion model who shocked Australia by wearing a miniskirt to the Melbourne Cup. I'll give you a little bit of a audio from it just to set the thing up, and then I'll talk about it for a bit.
The name of this young man is Stephen Shorter. He is being given the first ticker tape welcome in the history of Britain. But Stephen Shorter is not a president or a politician. He is a pop singer. The reason given for the extreme violence of the stage act that you are about to see is that it provides the public with a necessary release from all the nervous tension caused by the state of the world. Outside. The performance for which Stephen Shorter is now being prepared is based on the sentence he once served in prison. And so successful has this violent act become that Stephen Shorter now finds himself the most desperately loved entertainer in the world. In the near future.
Okay, there's the setup for it. Peter Watkins is a very interesting director. Before this, he made a TV adaptation of The Battle of Culloden, which gained him a lot of credit. It was extremely well done. He also did a thing called The War Game, which was a pseudo-documentary about Britain after a nuclear attack, which was incredibly violent. Incredibly graphic, incredibly imaginative, and was considered very, very shocking in its day. And from people who've seen it recently, unfortunately I've never seen it, it still is pretty shocking. This was his movie after The War Game, Privilege. It stars Paul Jones, who is now a BBC Radio 2 DJ doing rhythm and blues show. And from my readings, is also a part-time evangelist, which is very interesting considering the fascist religious revival meeting which takes place in Privilege. But people's belief systems are their own, and I shouldn't really knock him for that. The interesting thing about Jones in this role is that he's not a particularly good actor, which it works in favour of him playing Steve Shorter, because right from the very start of the film, it is very, very obvious that the Steve Shorter character is on the verge of a nervous breakdown. He's tense, withdrawn. He finishes his stage act where he's imprisoned and beaten up by coppers and sings songs about being set free. And when he comes backstage, his hands are bleeding from the handcuffs. And while all of his hangers-on and groupies and pseudo-celebrities gather around, he just sits in the corner and collapses. It's a very telling moment about the nature of some forms of celebrity. And it becomes increasingly obvious during the movie that Steve Shorter is, on all levels, by all people except one in his life, being manipulated, being milked as a total cash cow, being used to further the agendas of the coalition government in the UK in the near future that they have, which is above all looking at creating conformity among the masses, keeping the proles down, keeping the class structure intact. And there's a scene where they unveil the new fashion look, and it's very much a neo-Edwardian kind of thing. They're looking to the past for the future to emulate. In the meantime, Stephen Shorter is incredibly popular. There are Stephen Shorter shops. There are Stephen Shorter radios made in the shape of his head. There's a scene where he's sitting with the woman he meets, played by Jean Shrimpton, just surfing through the radio channels on a wrist radio. The only songs he can pick up are his own, and this is the song. Hey, little girl, I whole film, Privilege, is done like the War Game as a pseudo-documentary. Not exactly a mockumentary, because they tend to be humorous subjects, but there are scenes where the characters look at the camera and you get a little bit of camera shadow every now and then. They react to the camera as if there was a camera crew, so it's very much done in that manner. There are a couple of scenes where, of course, the camera crew probably would not be. There are a couple of intimate scenes between the Gene Shrimpton character and Steve Shorter, which step out of that documentary moment. But as the movie continues, Steve Shorter gets closer and closer to a nervous breakdown, being used, for instance, to do an advertising campaign for an apple glut, where to survive the apple glut, everyone in England has to eat 6 apples a day for the next 3 months. So there's a slight underpinning of humour there, but in general, it's a very didactic and harsh movie, a dystopian picture of how fame and celebrity and pop culture can be subverted for nefarious means by the powers that be. In that way, it's an unusual film for its time. It was filmed and released during the Summer of Love, 1967, so it went totally against the zeitgeist. Everybody else thought the age of Aquarius had come. But Watkins was saying, watch out, these people, you know, you may have the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the Doors and all these other bands, but the people making the real money are the people running the record companies, the management people, all of that. And there is a very telling moment when Stephen Shorter is taken aside by the man who runs his management company, who gives him a moment of real politic, which I found very, very chilling.
There are millions of people down there. Millions of little people. First, we must be quite clear in our minds about one thing. That the liberal idea that given enough education, these millions will grow into self-aware, creative human beings, is nothing but an exploded myth. It can never happen. They're stunted little creatures with primitive emotions that are in themselves dangerous. They've got to be harnessed, guided. We've seen this happen over and over again for an evil purpose. Germany, Russia, China. But now we've got a chance to make it work for their own good. You. You're our chance, Stephen. They identify with you. They love you. Stephen, you can lead them into a better way of life, a fruitful conformity.
As the movie progresses, Steve Shorter's people basically pimp him out to the combined churches of England, which are doing a large crusade and revival meeting to reinforce the government message of conformity. They run basically a Nuremberg rally in London to start the future as they want it, to start the conformity. They have a fire and brimstone preacher who tells people they must carry a car with them, saying, I will conform. Steve Shorter is a part of this. He repents. He stops being the rebel. He stops being the incarcerated man and becomes free and one of God's children. And this leads to him having a total breakdown, and during a large public event where he's being given an award, he loses it. Not in a big way, tells them that they treat him wrong and they don't treat him like a person, they treat him like a commodity. And the movie goes to a very stark and chilling ending based on that. This is an interesting film. It didn't say what people wanted to hear at the time it was made, but now it's considered a classic. It's a slow burn. A lot of movies are a slow burn. At the time they're made, they're misunderstood. And it's not realised in general that they speak to a certain aspect of their times. And this movie does. It's very interesting. I think it's a very memorable film too. I first saw it when I was a teenager. and the memory of it stuck with me. It struck me very powerfully at the time. About 10 years ago when I was in San Francisco, I was lucky enough to pick up a copy of the soundtrack. It was going for like $3 in a record store in Haight Street, in Haight-Ashbury. So for me, there's a circularity there. This movie was the antithesis of The Summer of Love, and I picked up a copy of the soundtrack of it in the heart of The Summer of Love in Haight-Ashbury. So for me, it's a very interesting film. You can find it around. I believe it was released on DVD. My copy of it is not, but given the opportunity, I will pick it up and see if there's any good ancillary material. I'll put a link on the show notes to Peter Watkins' website so he can talk about his experiences of making the film, and they are very interesting. I'll leave it to you to find it if you choose to. I think that in some ways it's an important film, and in a lot of ways it does have things to say about the junction of politics and celebrity these days. And with the American elections coming up, and to be truthful, they do affect pretty much everyone on the planet, it's not untimely to revisit this film and to see what it has to offer us as a message. Anyway, that's it for the podcast. It has now gone very, very long, but then it's the first anniversary podcast. Not too bad for that. Let me know what you think about the list I made of science fiction films. I think it may have gone on a little long. I do apologize for that if you got a bit bored in the middle there. But tell me anything I've missed, things you might like. We can have a bit of a discussion around that if you want. And again, the email address is kultguru@gmail.com. That's about it for this time. Enjoy your movie watching. Let me know what you're watching. And I will be back in 3 weeks with the 20th of the Paleo Cinema podcasts. Okay, enjoy your viewing.